Chapter 4. Funding F-Ups. There is one overarching, repeated explanation why most startups fail. It's the very short story founders spill the most, and which their understanding audiences apparently seem to accept. It's a five-word reasoning called, "We ran out of money." A stubborn myth ranking up there with favorites such as how bulls get angry when they see the color red. Like other cattle, they're actually red-green colorblind. That goldfish have a few seconds of memory, make that months, and how we only use 10% of our brains. Yes, I also found the 2014 Scarlett Johansson's starring movie Lucy entertaining, but of course we use virtually all parts of our brains. Do you believe that the key to turning your great business idea into a reality is to secure outside funding? That an investor's monetary blessing will all but ensure your company's success? If so, you're not alone. When I talk to founders in the early phases of building their businesses about how it's all going, their focus, 9 times out of 10, references their pitch deck. Sometimes they include which big-name venture capitalist they're wooing and the pie-in-the-sky valuation they're seeking. I'm sympathetic. That's what people seem to do these days, and a crappy cash flow can crush even the strongest ventures. Still, I don't hesitate to warn founders about the many funding failures that can and will derail their startups if they're not careful. Funding F-up number 1. Getting funded. If you aren't independently wealthy with money to burn, funding is something that cannot be ignored when creating a startup. The first problem you can run into when funding a startup is getting funded at all. The stats on this are actually surprising for most who have entrepreneurial spirits. As we'll see later in this chapter, those investments are a challenge. Listen to that to mean not impossible, but tiresome. When the time comes, a significant proportion of your time will be devoted to pitching, making acquaintances, making investment deals, and so on. The early days of your startup can sometimes get so hectic, and in all that chaos, it's easy to lose track of primary objectives, getting the best product possible and landing those early sales. Now, this is easy to say, but we all know that stupid feeling after a hard day's work when you finally hop into your bed expecting to get some sleep and thousands of insignificant, exaggerated worries immediately come to your mind. How will I do this? How will I do that? And then you realize that you need to step up your game and get more funding. The reality of things is this. The early focus on funding is often less rational than we want to believe. I'm not saying funding isn't significant, because we all know that funding is essential for a startup to survive. What I'm saying is that early on in your startup, the focus needs to be on the product, the business, and the market you're entering. Chasing funding rather than focusing on a product your market wants is just as dangerous as running out of money. Sound familiar? It should. I designed this book to take you through all the areas of a startup. It showcases where you might find the pitfalls, but it is also structured to prioritize each aspect. The fact that funding is buried in the middle of the book in Chapter 4 means it's something to think about, but not the most crucial factor early on. No matter how brilliant a founder is, or how groundbreaking their product is, those that focus on funding before all else find an imbalance in their business. This imbalance can take them from a startup success story to a cautionary tale in less time than anyone would expect. Take, for example, Pearl Automation. This automotive startup was founded by former Apple engineers Bryson Gardner, Joseph Fisher, and Brian Sander, who hired more ex-Apple employees, hoping it would help them gain that slick Apple feeling. And it did. Pearl Automation made an elegant rear-view camera, which acted as a frame for license plates. You could connect this camera to your smartphone. Though the company was founded in 2014, it didn't launch its first product until 2016. By 2017, their doors were closed permanently. What went wrong? A combination of high-reputation founders, who can easily convince investors, and too much focus on early funding. Pearl Automation received $50 million from venture capital companies based on the founders' reputations, and nobody thought about early sales. $50 million is quite a lot. I would argue more than they needed, considering I honestly don't see where that $50 million went. The product was simply too expensive. And if you were ready to pay $500 for a rear camera, you probably already had a car with this option. Nobody wanted to buy it. Everything looked good on paper, but once they started selling it, everyone knew Pearl Automation wouldn't see the end of 2017. Their burn rate was way too high, sales too low, and what was a good idea, making rear cameras available to everyone, not just those who had enough money for fancy cars, got dissolved by the early focus on funding. Some of the VC firms that funded Pearl Automation were Accel, Venrock, and Wellcome Trust. You can imagine the amount of time that went into talking with these large, reputable firms, convincing them that your previous Apple experience is enough for success. They could have spent this time much more wisely. While Moore's Law, which roughly translates into the doubling of processing power every 2 years, might be declining, it's still important to point out that dealing with hardware is pretty complicated. It's a field in constant development, but it's not as simple to make adjustments as it is with software. From needing replacement batteries and reconfiguring layouts, to constant innovation and update requirements that could change the product's entire design, hardware is a pain. You will find yourself running to and from the factory, which will probably be quite far away, getting that prototype done. Then you'll fret about its reception because each adjustment in serial production can be quite expensive. Combine that with the constant innovation and advancement coming from every corner, it is easy to get a high burn rate on a hardware startup. Hardware startups primarily fail due to lack of product market fit, which we will discuss in a later chapter. Overspending funding dollars comes in at a close second place. Pearl Automation hit both those mines. The fix. Know when and why. Get funded to prove your case, or prove your case to get funded. Obviously, this is an existential question, much like whether the chicken or egg came first. I digress not only for the entertainment value it can bring to the topic, but also because there are a ton of different solutions that all come at this failure from differing angles. Back in 2006, a team composed of a geneticist, philosopher, and chicken farmer worked together to answer the all-consuming question, finally. No, this isn't the beginning of a three-men-walk-into-a-bar joke. Drumroll, please. The egg came first. Professor John Brookfield, specialist in evolutionary genetics from Nottingham University, settled the discussion in an interview with the BBC, explaining that the DNA in the egg would have to be the same as that of the chickens, noting, "The first living thing which we could say unequivocally was a member of the species would be this first egg, so I would conclude that the egg came first." No more sleepless nights over that one. As I mentioned earlier, there are multiple ways to approach the problem of proving your case for funding or funding to prove your case. But like the three experts who determined the egg came first, I'll side with many other VCs on the sentiment that, first, you must prove your case for funding. Why? It's simple. Having funding at the outset of your startup can inadvertently hide the fact that your product is utter crap. Having the cash on hand allows you to ignore that your product is too costly for consumers, has too low of a price point to be profitable in the long run, or is facing any of the other myriad issues. When you have extra cash lying around, you don't have to immediately deal with the financial stress of an MVP or a product itself not performing well. Face it, money doesn't solve your failures. Getting funded too early is going to be too costly. If you come to me or any VC asking for funding, and it appears to be a huge risk at the stage you're in, The investor will want more equity to cover the investment. While the initial influx of cash may seem incredible, think 6 months down the road when your equity isn't what it could have been. How about 12 months? 18? How's that pit in your stomach feeling right now? The longer your startup exists, the greater the chance for change, and the constant pressure from VCs may be more hassle than helpful in the long run. So, smarty pants, you ask, how can I finance a company without funding? Elementary, my dear Watson, or whatever your name is. How do you bring in money to any company? Get a customer, or a few customers. Heck, get a bunch of them. Consider Glossier, which started as a beauty blog. Glossier began with Emily Weiss, a former fashion editor at Vogue. She's a champion of putting customers precisely at the center of her business. Unlike Pearl Automation, who focused on creating a product to amaze their VC firms and pay their investors back, Glossier started very, very slowly. After a few years of blogging and interviewing various potential customers, Weiss had enough information to start her brand. The customer feedback directly fueled the Glossier brand. Most notably, even though it was evident that Emily Weiss succeeded in creating a stable business, because she didn't want to rush funding. Glossier didn't sell to stores, necessitating a completely different infrastructure and thus more investments. With Glossier, we see that getting investments can be a good thing once the timing is right, and the market research proved her case. Emily Weiss pitched a lot of VCs, and some decided to fund her. Keep in mind that Emily worked on her product for years and only decided to seek capital when it became apparent she needed a way to keep customers interested over a long period. Pearl Automation, on the other hand, had a great product on paper, but listening to its users, it became obvious that the company focused more on pleasing the VCs than customers. Worse yet was the realization that in the U.S., since 2018, by law, car manufacturers have had to put rear cameras in all cars. This could have been easily predicted if a random commenter saw this coming in 2016. Instead, the founders were much busier running around, convincing VC officials that their Apple experience was enough. One more thing, and then we'll leave Pearl Automation to rest in peace. It was obvious that with minimal adaptation, they could have made their way into a potentially significant market: rear cameras for classic and significantly older cars. Enormous markets outside the U.S. exist where people drive slightly older cars. Funding FUP number 2, convoluting capital. There is such a thing as too much money, just as there is not enough money. Keeping capital simple is essential. A good startup can get funded. A bad startup can burn through capital. I learned the hard way that bootstrapping is best. I spent my first 10 years as an entrepreneur convoluting capital, thinking it was more challenging than it was to secure outside funding for my businesses. If I'd not succumbed to this failure, I do not doubt that several of my early ideas would be businesses today. Instead, I tied myself into knots, trying to figure out where the money would come from, exhausting myself to the point that I let many promising ideas die on the vine. Even with the first real business I bootstrapped, shockwaved, I ended up overcomplicating capital. About 2 years in, a marketing platform we were creating for a customer ended up being much more time-consuming than we'd thought. 2 months turned into 5 months, and we were in dire need of our final due-upon-completion payment. At this point in the game, it would have been entirely justifiable to seek funding. An easy solution would have been to book meetings with one or two of the angel investors I'd gotten to know through networking channels and propose a simple deal that boiled down to, "My company is growing year over year, and we need an immediate infusion of $100,000. Here are the numbers that show you'll likely make 5 times that in 5 years. What do you say?" Don't let articles with titles like "Why 99.95% of Entrepreneurs Won't Get Venture Capital" get to you. Even if it's true that most businesses won't even get the chance to see the inside of VC offices, there are many other sources of funding, including angel investors, private placements, even rewards crowdfunding or equity crowdfunding. That being said, there are many ways you can screw up by either overcomplicating funding or completely ignoring it, which are facets of the same failure. This happened to the Walnut Mentoring Platform, founded by Arpit Kothari. You've never heard about it because this guy, of course, didn't get the VC support. But neither did he try to fill the gap through other sources. Arpit wanted Walnut to be a sort of side thing, something that would bring him money without him doing anything. All he had to do, so he believed, was to start it, and the money would come all by itself. From my traditional Guju Marwadi upbringing, I was never in favor of raising funds, he stated. This was the first and most crucial mistake he made. While the company was profitable at the very start, because Arpit Kothari focused on short-term gains, ignoring long-term goals led to the ultimate decline. In a way, Arpit overcomplicated capital by ignoring it because he simply thought it was too much hassle. He didn't want his life to revolve around business, so he chose to run it as if bringing in capital were something scary. Although, as any entrepreneur can attest, it happened inevitably, but not because he got motivated and enthusiastic. He had to work more because things started crumbling in front of his eyes, and he always had to fill the gaps. Watching his business start to collapse ultimately forced him to confront capital needs. This begs me to make an additional point here. If you're looking to make a passive income, don't start a new business. Drop shipping isn't a passive income business model, no matter what some online articles will try to say to the contrary. If your goal in life is to make a passive income without working at something, I hope you're already independently wealthy and have a solid understanding of investment principles. Of course, that would be a topic for a completely different book. But consider this. The unheard of Okami Pack. Okami Pack was a field survival pack developed by Tim Chad, a 32-year-old American living and working in Japan, in 2014. One day, while at the office, an earthquake hit. He reached under his desk to find a pitiful, outdated emergency kit. With Japan being one of the most earthquake-prone countries globally, he felt he could design something people could use with an appeal to millennials. He partnered with a colleague, and together they went to work. Quitting his day job, he spent the next 10 months putting together a Kickstarter page, researching products for the kit, having a prototype designed and produced, and finding industry experts to review the kit. Want to hazard a guess what he didn't do? Launch the Kickstarter campaign. By June 2015, he had less than $1,000 in the bank and no prospective investors. In meeting after meeting, he realized if he clicked launch on his Kickstarter campaign, he wasn't just launching a product, but an actual business. With much introspection, one more point became painfully clear. He had no real attachment to his business. The next day, he deleted the 10 months in the making Kickstarter page he never launched. Back to funding. Don't sweat the small stuff here. It's important to spend some time and attention on the topic. But if you find yourself getting overwhelmed and ready to walk away and completely ignore it, you're only doing your business a huge disservice. This is a great area to reach out for assistance if it's not in your wheelhouse. We've discussed mentors and business partners already. These key people may hold the answers you need to address your biggest funding worries. People experienced in applying for and attaining funding can offer a lot of insight into the process and what is required from a business to achieve their funding goals in a variety of ways. Not every startup needs a venture capitalist firm backing them. As we discussed, the opposite is more likely. However, there are other funding avenues that can get you the funding you need to launch your business. Having originally never sat on the investor's side of the table, as I often do now, I simply couldn't believe funding could be easy. And it really is. Unless you're operating during a recession, getting funding isn't that complicated. The fix. Know how to pitch. To give yourself maximum leverage in the negotiation process, you'll of course need to have a comprehensive knowledge of your business model and all its numbers, which any founder should have. Then just show up to your meeting armed with a pitch deck that clearly states your value proposition, your modeling numbers, and an angle that maximizes your market validation and attraction. You'll need to show your potential investors all the key metrics, including what it costs to get a customer, your churn rate, any forecasted expenses, and predicted revenue. A good elevator pitch is a representation of you as a personality. Your business ideas, as well as current and past projects, are, of course, something to be mentioned, but not in a way you would present a business plan, which I'll explain later. You want to present yourself. In other words, an elevator pitch is a great thing when you're attending a social gathering with a lot of potential investors, clients, and business partners. Quite often, nobody expects to strike great deals during these events, only to make acquaintances that might turn out to be good business opportunities in the future. If you're presenting your business plan to VCs, you'll need a pitch deck. You'll want to highlight anything and everything attractive about your business. If you have a team with a strong track record, that will go a long way. Much further, in fact, than having the perfect business model. Finally, you should pitch like a king, not a beggar. It's not, "Can I please have some money?" It's, "Here's how I'm going to make you lots of money." And it's also about asking what they can offer you in addition to money, such as contacts or joining your board in an advisor role. You may have to talk to 20 to 50 different investors, but if you approach the process in a fairly structured way, you should be able to get this over with reasonably fast. And it's okay to bundle them up a bit. It does not hurt an investor to know that you have a meeting with a competitor later the same day. It's actually more of a requirement that you let them know that you have other options, politely and subtly, obviously. From there, it's really just a game of statistics in the same way as with any other sale. The more you have lined up, the more good meetings, the more proposals, and so on. If you've presented them with all the proper building blocks, there's no reason why several of the investors you meet with shouldn't be competing to fund you. As they do, make sure to have more than one negotiation going on at a time. This will give you A, options, and B, ammunition. The more interest there is in what you have to offer, the more confident you'll feel and appear in your negotiations, and the more the investors will want what you have to offer. Again, I didn't know any of this when I was 22. So what did I do? I took out an unsecured loan at a horrible rate to cover cash flow at Shockwaved. It was a stupid move that ended up costing us dearly and could have been avoided altogether if I'd practiced better budgeting. This brings me to our next funding failure. Funding F-up number 3. Bad budgeting. Balancing your startup budget is like going to heaven. Everybody wants to do it, but nobody wants to do what it takes to get there. It's all too easy to miscalculate the cost of running the different functions in your company. Rush through your budgeting process, and chances are you'll fail to assess your burn rate accurately. This is what sends the vast majority of companies down the drain. Don't make the same mistake. For many companies, one of the most significant expenses is the staff. It's a common budgeting mistake to hire too many employees too quickly, like Jim Picariello, founder of Wiseacre Frozen Treats. Founded in 2006, Wiseacre Treats made organic oxidants. Wiseacre didn't grow that much in its first 18 months. Picariello was the only employee. He made these organic popsicles out of his kitchen. After a year and a half of hard work, he hired one employee, and then 13 more after 6 months. Picariello moved his production to a 3,000-square-foot facility, and everything seemed to be going well. Seemed. Wiseacre went bankrupt by the end of that same year, in which it grew exponentially. Along with other budgeting mistakes, like taking on too large a lease for their headquarters, Picariello cited overstaffing as a critical reason why the company went bankrupt less than 3 years after being founded. On a much larger scale, take Zynga, a massive game development company that created wildly popular games like Words with Friends and Mafia Wars. In 2011, the company was doing so well that they invested heavily in staffing and building their own data centers, the latter to reduce costs, at the expense of $100 million, building their own data centers. What the heck were they thinking? By 2015, Zynga had closed down several of those centers and laid off 364 employees. The company is still around today, but it's far less successful than it was a decade ago. A depressing fate that could have been avoided if they'd avoided the bad budgeting failure. Finally, let's look at Scully, a company that fabricated AI-equipped bike helmets to allow motorcyclists the ability to have eyes in the back of their head. The helmets were promised to crowdfunding investors to provide a new level of safety and security while on the open road. Not only did Scully's founders, Marcus and Mitchell Weller, underestimate their cash requirement, but they also underestimated the savvy of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which investigated them for wildly misspending their investors' money. After 3 years of living the high life, blowing their company's cash on lavish vacations, strippers, and expensive sports tickets, the brothers were brought down in 2016. The fix. Meet the devil in the details. You can't be too detailed when it comes to your budget. The metrics you need to isolate and keep in your head at all times are your fixed versus your variable costs for the next 12 months. Your fixed costs are your rent, insurance premiums, loan payments, and any business costs that remain constant no matter your output. Your variable expenses are salaries, advertising expenditures, direct materials, commissions, and anything that fluctuates with your production. For example, if you're selling furniture, you'll calculate the expected costs of everything from your phone bills to your deliverables, to your vendors, to your transportation. If you're a tech company selling subscriptions, you'll need to assess your CAC, or customer acquisition cost, what you'll spend to move each customer from the point of their first visit to the point of their first purchase and beyond. Also, what's your churn? How many customers will you lose over time? Once you've plugged these key metrics into Excel, Numbers, or Google Sheets, or whatever program you like, to create a static budget, you can play around with different parameters and their budgetary consequences dynamically. Work out, for example, what would happen if I fired this person after 2 weeks? 6 months? What if I hired 3 salespeople in the first year? What if I reduced my advertising budget by 10%? Or if my conversion base was improved by 5%? By manipulating these parameters, you'll start to get familiar with the many different scenarios you might encounter from year 1 through 3, and budget for the most feasible scenario. Funding F-up number 4, the cap table cap size. There are only a few mistakes that cannot be undone. Messing with your cap table is one of those. Be the captain of your cap table. Your cap table, or capitalization table, shows who owns what in your startup, how much each of your company stakeholders owns, who invested in each financing round, and how their equity has been diluted over subsequent rounds. Sounds simple enough, but you can still F up massively by forgetting to keep a close eye on your cap table. Take your eye off this vital record, and the precious vessel of your company risks capsizing into dangerous waters. In other words, you may allow your share in your company to become overly diluted, which means you lose control. This failure is practically unfixable. Once you've sold, say, 50% of your company, you're obviously not in a position where you can just buy that stock back. If your investors even allow it, chances are you'll pay far more than you should. And certain percentages can mean that you lose votes, influence tax, etc. We can find an early example of the cap table cap size in Christopher Columbus's story, whose voyage could be considered one of the first significant venture capital deals. While Columbus's ship made it to its destination intact, Columbus, all the same, suffered from the cap table cap size. In a nutshell, The Spanish crown had promised the explorer 10% of all revenue from any lands he discovered in perpetuity. 10% of all of North and South America forever? That's a pretty good starting point. It's interesting to think about Columbus's voyage as one big investment. Most people focus on how he discovered America, probably discovered by my fellow Vikings some 500 years before he was born, but history is forgiving since it had already been discovered by its original inhabitants living there when he landed, forgetting that the whole expedition was just barely realized thanks to Columbus's incredible enthusiasm and zeal. In a way, it's like he had this great idea and knew how to make it happen, but just needed the funds. One thing Columbus didn't overcomplicate was capital. He knew very well how to pitch his idea to the big players. He was an Italian, but knew that Italians wouldn't give him the money, having tried his luck with Genoa and Venice, the wealthiest city-states. So Columbus asked the King of Portugal, who rejected him on two separate occasions. He then focused on the King of Spain, and these negotiations lasted from 1486 to 1492. While this was happening, Columbus didn't want to rely solely on Spain's king, so he sent his brother to England to request finances and ships from English royalty. Pirates captured his brother, the perks of living in the 15th century, and by the time he was released, Columbus already had a basic agreement with the Spanish crown. Besides the 10% of all lands, Columbus also negotiated another great deal. He had the right to buy at least 1/8 of commercial ventures tied to the land he would discover. While they did do a quite elaborate contract, capitulations of Santa Fe, the Spanish crown ultimately rejected his demand for payments. Bummer. Roughly 500 years later, the entrepreneur Steve Jobs would find himself in a similar position to the one Columbus faced. He embarked on a journey, and he wasn't quite sure how it would all end. Neither did his business partners, Steve Wozniak and Ronald Wayne. The latter made arguably one of the worst moves in the history of the business. He sold his 10% share in Apple just 12 days after the company was founded. In total, he received $2,300 for his 10% of Apple. A major cap table capsize, in my humble opinion, despite Ronald claiming to have no regrets. Wozniak and Jobs were shrewder. After the first fundraising round, Jobs had 26% ownership, which was reduced to 11% in 1985, before being removed from Apple. Perhaps when the Apple executives expressed their intention to replace him, in a moment of anger, he sold almost all of his shares and left Apple. Wozniak did the same thing, and also sold his share to about 7%. Sure, they didn't commit the same mistake as Ronald Wayne, especially Jobs, who invested in Pixar, made some serious money, and then repurchased some Apple shares. Jobs wouldn't repeat the same mistake. He held on to his Disney share, a comfortable 7%, to the very end. The worst thing is, most entrepreneurs are forced to give up on their original cap table. This happens way more often than you would expect, because entrepreneurs who had their companies taken away from them are silenced in every way, typically legally, but also illegally. The ways you can be forced to give up control and shares come in so many different shapes, and are mutating so fast that they are impossible to list here. Just be aware that majority control of your company can be reached by malignant investors in a number of different ways. They make a very complex legal case that includes reverse stock splits, stock dilution, and down rounds. In other words, everything an entrepreneur doesn't have time to get into, or at least is not an expert in. These guys can make a 99% ownership turn into a measly 1% in a single day. Make sure that you have qualified legal help before entering into any agreement. The fix. Talk specifics and get legal support before making a great deal with the big buys. This problem has a two-part solution, due mainly to the multiple components of the problem. Know whom you're working with and accept dilution. In addressing the basics, every startup needs to create a capitalization, or cap, table to designate company ownership. If you're founding the company with a co-founder or two, you'll want to make sure you vet them thoroughly, as their stake in the company will be outlined in this document as well. Don't panic. Co-founders and how to vet them will be covered in Chapter 6. There are plenty of mistakes to make here also. Any investors you consider getting into business with need a thorough vetting as well. Keep in mind, you should never only have one candidate. Considering multiple people as potential investors will give you the time to make a proper choice. The same is true when selling a company. You'll want to aim to get smart money, which is money that also comes with a network, knowledge in the startup world, and easier access to more capital later. On top of that, make sure any potential investors are people you can work with, since they will own a stake in your company. If you find them to be a real a-hole, reconsider. The advantage of having multiple parties to consider for these roles means you have the ability to help let the market dictate a reasonable sales price. This advantage will give you a better chance to know you made a good decision in hindsight. That covers part one. Know whom you're working with, whom you're borrowing from, and have specific conversations about who owns what percentage of what. The second part of the solution is accept dilution. Yep, it sounds scary, and to a certain extent it is, but if you need the cash, then it makes sense. If you, as an example, get funding plus a great mentor for your business, even though it might cost you 51% of the company, then it's not the worst situation. Many founders worry about dilution, but the reality is, eventually, it will happen. Stop worrying about what can't be controlled, because the harsh truth is you won't have control over your business's valuation entirely. This brings us sliding into the second part of the solution for any cap table failures. Before signing hefty contracts, you should hire a contract attorney, usually on a freelance basis. If you don't have that many yearly contracts, you don't need to hire a contract attorney full-time, as they don't come cheap. What to do when you don't have a contract attorney? Get one anyway. But in addition to this, good old reading will help and reduce the cost. You should do what you never do and read the terms and services very, very attentively. Each page is important, and sometimes the crucial information is strategically put in places where it's hard to notice. Every word in a contract is important. And even while doing this, always hire an attorney. Next, even when everything's okay and there are no signs of foul play, you should still have your paper version of the contract. Nowadays, there are so many online document signing services, and we sometimes forget how it was back in the day when a paper form was the standard. Having a printed, paper copy gives both parties the added security of a hard or wet copy. Sign all pages. Some contracts are required by law to be maintained in the paper form, especially when doing business outside your country of origin, and for certain holdings like real estate or some international employment agreements. Before you make any deals with big investors or VCs, consult your legal counsel. Do your due diligence researching the people you'll be working with, and make sure you understand how to protect your ass or assets best.